Well, thank you for coming to our colloquium in theoretical and applied mechanics. We're very excited today to have Bruce Lewenstein here. Now, as I was looking over Bruce's biography, it occurred to me that there's one word that comes to mind when I think about him, which is the word joint. The sense of that, you can interpret that many ways, but the way I mean it is that Bruce seems to be very good.
Right, aid. Never mind.
Bruce is terrific at doing two things at the same time. So, for example, when he was an undergraduate at University of Chicago, his subject was humanities joint with physical sciences. And here at Cornell, now as a full professor, he is joint between science and technology studies and communication. His PhD naturally was a joint thing. University of Pennsylvania, jointly in history and sociology of science and science and technology policy. So it seems altogether fitting that his topic today is on something joint, which is imagination in science, two wonderful topics that also seem to have brought in an unusual audience for us, a bit broader than normal. So we're delighted to have Bruce here. And we, as a little token of our esteem, would like to give you what's inside the box, which is a cup about our own attempt at being joint theoretical and applied mechanics. So thank you, Bruce.
Thank you, Steve. I appreciate it. I sometimes actually use all of those joint things as a way into the fact that all of the interesting questions for me are at the interstices between the interstices. You know, there's sort of every time I find something, well, there's this neat stuff on the edge that connects over here. Oh, there's something. You know. Of course, the problem is, meanwhile, I've left behind whatever expertise I actually have. So, there's some sense in which I have the advantage of being able to range very broadly, the disadvantage of sometimes not going deeply. So I'll be very glad to sort of get questions from you about ways that from your perspective as scientists and engineers, you see the ways that some of these topics, some of the things I talk about, sort of intersect with what you do, particularly this notion of imagination and where imagination plays a part in your work. I guess I have to turn this on if I want it to work. There we go. So this is a talk that's based in a project that I'm doing. Actually, we want to leave the lights up, Andy, and it because of we're filming is the problem. Is there a halfway point? that makes it worse. That makes it worse. Yeah, that's not going to work. Yeah, there we go. That works.
Perfect.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, no, we actually spent we spent time playing with this in advance. So I'm working on a project about the history of science books in the years after World War II. And it's a time when we sort of say, well, what role do books play? Why would we even bother? I mean, it is, after all, history, stuff that's passed. But it turns out to be kind of interesting, because if we look and we say, you know, why would we even bother to look? Well, first off, partly as with all academic topics, it was because somebody asked me to. There's a 5-volume history of the book in America that's being produced by supported by the National Endowment for the Humanities. I was asked for the 5th volume post-World War II. Did they need to include science in that? And went to look and said, well, yeah, it turns out maybe it would make sense to put it in there. And part of the thing that makes it interesting is that, in a sense, it's counterintuitive, right? So if I ask most of you, are books important? The first reaction would probably be, well, no, if in terms of science, if it's not in a journal, it's not real science, right? And yet, as I walked into this building, as you walk in immediately to your left, is a display case showing books produced by people in this department, right? Books, it turns out, continue to play a very important role in science in a variety of ways. And a deep project, sort of the full project looking at it, turns out to be useful as a way of looking both at science itself and the history of science itself, but also about issues of how science and the broader culture intersect and interact and produce each other. Now, some of the ways that science books play that books play a role in science. First, there's the daily life of science, right? So it turns out that there is primary literature. There are conference proceedings in some fields. In fact, conference proceedings are effectively the same thing as journals. Computer sciences these days, that's how you publish. There are also festschrifts, which sometimes celebrations of someone's career, which sometimes turn out to be crucial. Best example of this is in the early 1960s, during just at the time that continental drift was reemerging and strengthening, and a geologist, a geophysicist from Princeton named Harry Hess, began to see that all the evidence was fitting together, and this idea of continental drift really might work, but he couldn't really prove it. And so he wrote a paper in which he said, I can't prove this. This idea that I can't prove, I'm going to call it geopoetry. I'm going to put this together. Having said that, he then couldn't get it published anywhere. And he ended up putting it into a festschrift for one of his old professors. And so one of these key articles, the one that sort of inspired people to put all the pieces together, appears in a festschrift. There are other kinds of examples. Obviously, in terms of the secondary literature, if I say CRC handbook, how many hands go up? And there's an age distribution notice in those hands that went up, right? Everybody over a certain age probably got their first CRC handbook when they were in high school, taking physics or chemistry or math, because these were the books that had all the formulas you needed and the tables that you had to look up and so on. Now we all do it on the web or on our PDAs or whatever. But as a standard tool of everyday science, you had to have your CRC handbooks. There would be data sets in some fields that were published in book form. Conference proceedings, again, the review literature. And then, of course, there's textbooks, right? One of the most fundamental ways that science gets transmitted from one generation to the next is through textbooks. And there are some key aspects of how textbooks are organized that change the way people look at the field. In physics, for example, if I say Halliday and Resnick, how many hands go up? And if I say Sears and Zemanski, it's the other half of the room, right? Between those two textbooks, those introductory physics textbooks, almost everybody in this room used one of those two at some time. Those two books in their original versions were written by engineering professors for engineering students in the late 50s, early 60s. Well, roughly, basically, we'll say the 50s. Quantum mechanics was almost literally tacked on to the end of those books. The worldview that those books presented to as the most popular books in the second half of the 20th century was very much a 19th century view of what the world is like. Now, there's obviously good pedagogical reasons why that happens. But if you think about all the people who took only 1 year of physics, the view of physics that they have, this quantum stuff is really still very weird. You never really even got there, probably.
In this room, it still is considered weird.
Oh, okay, well, I didn't want to make assumptions, there's some top administrators here, you think about that, how that goes. Chemistry books. Some of you may actually have known Cienko and Plain, who were chemistry professors here at Cornell, who wrote a very famous textbook. It was published in the, when was Cienko and Plain, 57, I think? Something around there, which restructured how people approach chemistry and how people think about the relationships between chemistry. So that these books, textbooks, turn out to be very important. Then there are these connections to broader culture that books provide us, so that there are times when you can use books to follow the intellectual developments in science, where sort of what are people thinking about? Books that are written sort of for the insider, but sort of for the outsider. I'm thinking of something like E.O. Wilson's Sociobiology, which was his attempt to pull together all of his ideas into a single place. But it was also written to make his ideas open and available to a broader audience. Weizenbaum's computer reasoning book, I've forgotten the exact title, another book sort of written to pull the ideas together. We also have the ideas, the many books that were written for bringing people into science. So again, I'm going to do a show of hands. Paul de Kruijf's Microbe Hunters. How many of you read it as a child? It's getting to be just a little. Well, we got one, the younger one, but one. Watson's Double Helix, another one. Now my problem is I don't. Carl Sagan's Cosmos. I thought, Okay, so we've got these ones. Cosmos is the TV show, and we'll get to that. But it's also a book, and that's the question. But these things that recruit people in. There are books that are part of public debate. So Herrnstein and Bell's The Bell Curve, which was about racial distribution. And then you have something we have no word for in English, culture scientifique, the idea that science is an integral part of society, and you're simply not an educated person if you aren't paying attention to some aspects of science. So these are things like Lewis Thomas's Essays in Medicine. Or books like Sink. Books that are sort of, written so anybody who's reasonably educated can get to them, but they're not wild bestsellers. They're not flying off the shelves at airports, I don't think. but they get reviewed in The New Yorker or in, and sometimes some collection of related books will show up in The New York Review of Books. They're things that cultured people, what the British would call the chattering classes, that they talk about. So if I look at these kinds of books, particularly these public books, over the post-war period, what I discovered, here's my graph. I want you guys to tell me how this works, if we can do this. So these are new titles, new science-related books added to the New York Times bestseller list each week from 1945 to 2000. And it's a pretty noisy graph, obviously, but what you can see is that until the mid-1970s, there's almost never a year when there are more than 10 new books added to that list. After the 1970s, there's almost never a year, or relatively few years, when there are fewer than 10 books added to that list. There's some kind of inflection point going on here in the 1970s. It turns out that, I'm not going to show it today because I want to do a different talk, but there's a lot of other evidence that I can pull on that would suggest that something happens in the mid to late 1970s where there's a change in our culture and more people start paying attention to science. There are more science TV shows then. There are after many years of there being no Pulitzer Prizes or National Book Awards in science, suddenly they start coming every other year. There's growth of popular science magazines. There's the growth of science sections in newspapers. There's a whole bunch of things that happen in about a five-year period there. Suggests that there's something different about American culture. I'm talking about American culture now. About American culture in those years right after, in those late 70s years. All kinds of possible explanations. Some of it has to do with the baby boom. The baby boomer kids are now in the late 70s getting to have their own disposable income, and these are the kids who've been educated in a post-Sputnik era. So that's a possibility. It may have something to do with some splits in American culture between authoritarian views of the world and anti-authoritarian, sort of an aftermath of the disputes of the 1960s. There's all kinds of possibilities. However, that's not what I'm going to talk about today. T- Today I want to talk about what makes a top book. What is it that got something into that category of top books? And I'm thinking of here of sort of books that were bestsellers that are, actually left that slide out, that's dumb. There's a list of things like Heyerdahl's Kon-Tiki and Kinsey's sex books, actually, and Masters and Johnson's book and so on, and sort of what ended up being making those books popular. The first one is that books with a strong authorial presence, where you really saw the author, clearly were more likely to become bestsellers, where you felt like you were talking directly to the author had a point of view. They were often books like Thor Heyerdahl's books of Kon-Tiki and his later one, Aku Aku, that were storytelling, narrative books. Rachel Carson's first book, not the one that she's most known for, Silent Spring, but actually her earlier book about the oceans around us. She was a very well-known author in the 1950s. Where it's telling stories, and these tended to make books very popular. I've mentioned Masters and Johnson and the Kinsey books. Sex sold, right? You know, books that were about sex tended to sell, even though any of you who've ever tried to look at the Kinsey books would know that these are not easy reading. This is not easy reading. This is not salacious. It's really dull. but it sold anyway, which is really interesting. There were some other ones as well. And then for those of you who are movie fans, we get the Sex, Lies, and Videotape. I actually don't have any books that were lies, but I really needed that to make the transition to videotape, which is really what I want to talk about today, which is a series of books that where the book was also attached to a movie or to a television show or video of some kind. And some interesting things that come when you look at those books. And the reason I did this was that I had noticed that several of the bestsellers, and I'll end up talking about three of them, had this connection with video. And I was trying to figure out what was the connection between the visual imagery and the textbooks, or and the visual imagery in the movies and these best-selling books. And I started thinking about imagination and sort of the role that imagination played. And that was partly sparked by the fact that I ran into these two quotes. One of these, this one, which is from an interview with Albert Einstein that was published in the 1920s in the Saturday Evening Post. The place where I saw this quote was, you know, on your credit card bill, there's little inspirational sayings. Yeah, well, this was the inspirational saying on one of my credit card bills. But, you know, it struck me. Here I was, you know, thinking, okay, so Albert Einstein telling me imagination, the great scientist telling me imagination is more important than knowledge. And then I ran into this quote from Wallace Stevens, who's a famous American poet, saying, eventually, an imaginary world is entirely without interest. So here I have the poet telling me that imagination is useless, or not useless, but ultimately without interest. And I've got the scientist telling me that imagination is supreme. That doesn't fit my expectations. So what I was trying to do then was say, okay, so what's going on here? What's happening? So the three cases that I'm going to look at are Jacques Cousteau's Silent World, Jacob Bronowski's Ascent of Man, and Carl Sagan's Cosmos. Silent World appeared as a movie in, I'll tell you each of these as we get to them. Let me just ask, how many of you have seen the movie Silent World? Our professional videographer. Oh, we got one other one. Okay. Bronowski's Ascent of Man. How many of you saw it originally when it was on TV? How many of you have seen it later? A few, okay. Carl Sagan's Cosmos, originally when it appeared, and later, more, okay. How many of you saw clips of one of these in a schoolroom someplace, as a teacher showed it? A lot of you, right? You know, so these ones got pulled out as schools. Well, each one of them is associated with a best-selling book as well. And each one of them has some really interesting things to say about imagination. So let's talk first about Jacques Cousteau. Jacques Cousteau started coming to sort of public notice in the years immediately after World War II, about 1948, he's being covered in Science Illustrated magazine, which was a short-lived popular science magazine, something like Discover or Popular Science. He was the first of the men fish. He gets his first cover of National Geographic in 1952. And then in 1953, this movie, Silent World, comes out by Captain J.Y. Cousteau. It's not the movie. It's the book that came out in 1953. The book comes out in 1953. It was on the bestseller, New York Times bestseller list for 33 weeks, most of that time in the top five. Never made it to number one, but it was often number three or four. And it's a then 3 years later, the movie version came out. So the book came out well before the movie. The movie is an astonishing film. And we're going to, if all goes well, we're going to see a brief bit of it. This is the opening scene. What's your reaction to the film?
Somebody should help me.
Slow moving.
Very slow moving.
Photography is beautiful.
Photography is amazing. If you just keep watching it, it's hard to believe it was shot 50 years, more than 50 years ago. Right? Those of you who, if you go to an IMAX and see an underwater film today, it's got imagery that's sort of the same. It's not that much more dramatic. It's astonishing. Notice the silence of that first, of that long opening scene, right? It's the silent world. You're down there, all you hear are your bubbles. Any of you who's done any scuba diving, you know what that feels like. I've only recently been able to get hold of a copy that I can show. I saw the movie some years ago, but it's actually very hard. I'm even a little uncertain about the legality of that movie, of that clip that I've just shown you, because it's hard to get a copy. It hasn't been released in formal ways. But I was able to get a legal copy from the Cousteau Society some years ago to watch, but with the explicit proviso that that copy was not to be shown in public, was not to be shown to anybody, I couldn't copy it, and so on. So if you're in that situation where you have to take notes, the things that strike you about the movie, the way that it's a narrative, right? He introduced us to the ship, and it goes on telling us about the pieces of the ship. It's an expedition. There's a lot about life on board the ship. There are scenes of them eating and sleeping and so on. There's a lot about going to exotic places and things like that. Lots of references to the danger of narcosis, diving narcosis. Actually, one of those people, I think it was Falco, ended up dying shortly after, just after the movie was completed in a diving accident. There's also lots of shots that today we would hate to see, a sort of gruesome shark feedings and things like that. There's lots of both language and imagery lots of imagery. And even the language is very evocative language. So there are talks of cameras flashing in the darkness of the deep, weird colonies, the universal blue he talks about, the warmer colors as they go deeper, nightmare shapes. And then there are long stretches of the movie that are just silent, or all you'd have is just the underwater scenery. What's interesting from our point of view for today is there's an anti-imagination about it. It's about showing you exactly what it's like underwater. So you get those bubbles and the flames, right? That's really what's happening down there. In one of the written things, not specifically in the movie, but in one of his written things, Cousteau has this. He says he merely wants to be the poet of the new realm he has claimed for menfish. He sighs when he tries to describe you what it's like to live in the sea. I cannot tell you how much better than the imagination it is downstairs. Better than the imagination. There's a reality to it, a sort of a tactile completeness to it. That for him is very important. That's what he calls going below water, going downstairs. it's also really important to him that this be true. At one point, during the filming, they were filming a wreck of some kind, and the director said, "It'd be really cool if we could find a skeleton down there, you know, really get the eeriness of it," or so on. They couldn't find any skeletons in the wreck, so they brought one down, and they filmed it. But in the end, they didn't use that piece of film, because he said, "That would have been fake, and I'm not going to show you anything that's fake. I'm not going to imagine anything. I'm going to show you what really is down there." So here we have Cousteau, who, you know, obviously an extraordinary entrepreneur, a good engineer. He is one of the co-inventors of the Aqualung, although he's not the inventor. But someone who had, you know, this vision and this ability to tell stories that we could do. For him, imagine it, but he's not really a scientist, and yet you saw that. I mean, I called attention to his words there. We're doing all of this in the service of science. I don't actually know how much science was produced by Cousteau things. Yeah, Salman?
I would just like to say that a lot must be to do with Louis Malle's involvement. Louis Malle is one of the greatest directors. And I just recently saw a Louis Malle film on the TV and was extraordinarily struck, A, by the silences, and B, by the same type of imagination that
right. showing. It, absolutely. I mean, the fact that this movie, this was actually Louis Malle's first major film. And he was sort of an apprentice and when Cousteau, so he got recommended to Cousteau. Clearly, the power of this film has a lot to do with that. But it also, you know, so I'm not going to attribute this just to Cousteau. Part of what it suggests is Cousteau, one of Cousteau's abilities was the ability to put together a team, right? You know, he was a manager. But I want to focus, you know, on this issue of sort of imagination and truth. Now I want to jump ahead 20 years to Bronowski and The Ascent of Man. The Ascent of Man was designed as a television program by the BBC in the UK. It was an explicit follow-up to an earlier series by Sir Kenneth Clarke called Civilization. That series, which had appeared in the late 1960s, was superb, but had no science at all. It was about art and music and things like that. It was not about, it had no science at all. So there was a critique that for all that was superb, it had left out this big chunk of cult of civilization. And so the BBC approached Bronowski, who was a well-known mathematician, philosopher, commentator by that point. And part of their vision, part of what the BBC was looking for, based in part on the Clark Civilization series, was a real personal vision. They wanted you to feel the person. So although this is the official publicity photo of Bronowski, this is actually the one I prefer. This is a drawing which captures his cragginess. This is near the end of his life when this comes along. So let's watch a few minutes of the introduction to Ascent of Man. For Bronowski, as you saw, sort of, I call it science triumphant. It's about science and scientific research and scientific ideas being the pinnacle of human evolution. But it depends on imagination. It's, in a sense, the exact opposite of what Cousteau said. Here's that quote that we just heard. "His imagination, his reason, his emotional stability and toughness make it possible for him to accept, not to accept the environment, but to change it." And that series of inventions he calls The Ascent of Man. For a lot of viewers, what they remember from that series was Bronowski. Just this incredibly strong personality. One reviewer, a chemical educator named Truman Schwartz from McAllister College, in a review shortly afterwards said, "Bronowski included many scientific facts in his presentation, but what still gives the series its intensity some years later are his well-identified asides and his strongly held opinions. In rewatching the series, I am impressed by the care with which Bernowski generally identifies the bases for his statements and his assertions. Spurred by imagination, but very clearly identifying sort of what his assumptions are and how he's moving ahead. There's that quote. Bernowski then begat Carl Sagan. Carl Sagan, who it was interesting. I had lunch with some of the students here today, and one of them asked me this Sagan name. I know I'm supposed to know it. It's, you know, didn't he have something to do with Cornell? And you know, for those of us who knew him, it has now been 11 years since he died. It's a while. And our students, when I teach science communication courses and I say Carl Sagan's name, there's a total blank across 19-year-old faces. He does not have a presence for younger. So as many of the Reed people in this room know, he was an astronomer, came to Cornell in the late 1960s, explored planetary atmospheres as spacecraft went out through the solar system, and also wrote some of those, part of that bump in popular science in the late 1970s. His book, Dragons of Eden, which won the Pulitzer Prize in 1978, is one of the major markers. It's the first of those new books that sort of mark that rise. Well, after Ascent of Man, which was successful both in the U.S. and both in the U.K. and then in the U.S., PBS decided that Public Broadcasting Service here decided it wanted to do something similar, and by this point Sagan was becoming well known, and they turned to him with the idea of creating what became Cosmos. The producer for Cosmos, named Adrian Malone, was the producer for Ascent of Man. So there's a very direct lineage here of what led to the show being produced, and in fact the major producer. There's a difference in the relationship to the books. The book Ascent of Man is literally just the scripts of the shows. But the book Cosmos, although tied to the show and covering the same material in each chapter, is separately written. Sagan wrote a separate book in addition to the scripts to go with it. In fact, according to people who did careful reviews, the book was actually reviewed even better than the TV show. Quote, the book is as magnificent, challenging, and idiosyncratic as Cosmos, the TV series. It is also a better product. That was a well-known science writer who did that. The book spent about 70 weeks on the bestseller list. Part of the success of the series appeared in the fall of 1980. Part of the reason it was a success, besides its inherent quality, was that just as we are right now, there was a TV writer's strike. And so most of the other shows were in reruns. And so this was actually one of the few fresh shows on TV at the time. But as I say, there was inherent quality. As with the Bernowski, there's this personal vision. Cosmos was billed as, quote, a personal statement, one man's apologia for his faith called science. There's actually a lot of sort of religious faith or imagery that goes through Cosmos. I'm not going to spend time on that, but it's another place where one can do some interesting things looking at the place of religious imagery and relationship with religion. So let's watch the introduction to Cosmos. So I'm sure you all saw the reference to imagination there. You know, why did the show become such a hit? Partly because it was fascinating. Partly it was the force of his personality. It was this sort of the profile, the full faceness, the wind blowing and all of that. The becoming of a celebrity, as the biographies of Sagan have shown. And he became a true celebrity, the kind of person who couldn't go into a restaurant without having people interrupting him. It had major implications for his life. But for now, let's focus on this. So what did he say? He said, there was again this fact and speculation piece, as there was in the Bernowski. We wish to pursue the truth no matter where it leads. But to find the truth, we need imagination and skepticism both. We will not be afraid to speculate, but we will be careful to distinguish speculation from fact. That sense of the imagination, many of those of you who've seen the series will remember there was the Imaginarium, the spaceship that was that he was often in. Truth was critical to Sagan's view of what would be there. Once in the middle of a take on the show, Sagan and his co-writer and fellow planetary scientist Steve Soter, they stopped to calculate, literally on the, this is from one of the biographies, to calculate literally on the back of an envelope the amount of oxygen in a planetary moon's atmosphere. Sagan was absolutely committed to getting the science right, recalled one of the other creators, Jeff Haynes-Stiles. And yet, it was the celebrity rather than the facts that helped make the show a success. Time magazine said that in the casualness of turtleneck jersey and chino pants, his butcher boy haircut tousled by the wind, Sagan sends out an exuberant message. Science is not only vital for humanity's future well-being, but it is rousing good fun as well. Another Time reporter recognized what has sometimes been called the Sagan effect, that is, the problem of a scientist who's a little too popular. Watching with wonder, and no doubt a little envy, the whirling star named Sagan, wrote this Time reporter, some of his colleagues feel that he has stepped beyond the bounds of science. They complain that he is driven by ego. They also say that he tends to overstate his case. He often fails to give proper credit to other scientists, and he blurs the line between fact and speculation. That was this constant charge of, was there a blurring there? For Sagan, there was this, this constant tension. There was another review a few years later, frequent failure to point out the difference between observation and reconstruction, a systematic blurring of the distinction between proof and assertion, between fact and hypothesis. For Sagan, imagination was necessary. Right? You couldn't do, the things he was looking at are things you can't see. You had to imagine in order to be able to see them. You also had to be able to imagine in order to explain things. And he was frankly interested in entertaining. He did not hide the fact that that part of his goal was to entertain people, in part to recruit young people into science, that that was one of his goals. Ultimately, what he was trying to convey was a vision of science as something that one would bring in. As many of you know, a lot of his work had to do with extraterrestrial life, places where you had to imagine, and there were formulas, but you had to sort of, you know, reach out as well. So I've had these three cases of imagination in science. Let me try to see if I can come up with a conclusion. As I said, you know, in the earliest one, the Cousteau one, we've got drama, but we've got a sort of anti-imagination. We have to be real. Whereas the later two, Brunowski and Sagan, seem to be much more about using imagination in order to get you to the truth. Imagination is necessary. Question of what counts as the truth. Drama works, but there's a tension there. This is sort of my conclusion. Because now we get to the post-conclusion, right? 2 weeks ago or 3 weeks ago, whatever it was, Al Gore shared in the Nobel Peace Prize for his role in popularizing issues of global climate change. If you read the Nobel Peace Prize citation to him, he's for a long time been one of the world's leading environmentalist politicians. His strong commitment reflected in his political activity, his lectures, films, and books. As far as I know, this is the first Nobel Prize for science communication, which makes me feel good. There's hope for someone in my field, though he's better at it than I am. But there is this same, you know, I haven't gone back yet to relook at Inconvenient Truth, the movie and the associated book, to see sort of what they do. There is this inspirational aspect to it, so that the company that produced it, if you go to their website, they produce a number of other movies, some of which are sort of blockbuster Hollywood hits, They believe in the power of media to create social change. Their goal is to deliver compelling entertainment that will inspire audiences to get involved in the issues that affect us all. It's this inspirational element to what they're doing. Does it fit that model of sort of imagination and truth intention? There is the question, you know, I ask you all, is there drama? Well, some of you may remember Al Gore's speech at the 1996 Democratic Convention during the height of the Macarena craze, when he said, you know, I can do the Macarena. Want to see me do it? Want to see me do it again? imagination, I don't know. I'm going to have to go back and look. But I think, again, there's probably this, I'm going to guess that there's this tension between imagination and truth. So clearly here at Cornell, we have people who can imagine strange things, like pumpkins on the top of the clock tower. So I'll stop there. Thank you very much. And I'm glad to take questions, whatever.
Well, it seems to me that Cousteau is just saying those words, but he can't stop people from imagining lots of things, such as whether those divers are going to get eaten up by something, for instance. We know they didn't, because otherwise we wouldn't get the film back. But it's equally dramatic that way, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I just think him saying that is in many ways irrelevant to the impact of the movie.
Mm-hmm. And of course, for many of us, there are those of us who are scuba divers who have seen it, but for anyone who isn't, you don't get to go down and see that stuff. And so you do have to imagine it through his imagery. So yeah, there's a clear tension between what he's saying and what's actually happening.
Do you feel like the contribution of the imagination from these two is part of your graph in the somewhat, because otherwise it's just this dry, dull science that no one knows and understands or cares about, and then suddenly it's the imagination. Is it a way to reel people in? Anyway.
I think in Sagan's case it probably is. I'm not sure, but I think there, that sort of ability to imagine and to project his imagination so other people, and there are obviously people here who knew him well and could probably speak to that, but that's part of the appeal. Bronowski, I'm not as sure. Bronowski is, there's much less imagination. I mean, he refers to imagination, but there's less of it, I think, in the show than there is in Sagan. In terms of the timing of it, this is the danger of having only three data points, or four if I count Gore, that I don't know whether I want to tie it to that late 70s idea. Obviously, Cousteau is earlier, the other two are later. You know, maybe there's something there. I'm not sure about that yet. Dick?
I wonder if the late 70s explosion in these books is related to the general education of the American public. And it's really the post-Sputnik era that launched a whole generation of technocrats and then refueled by the computer revolution. And so you have a lot of people who are interested in science that didn't used to be there before.
No, I think that that's actually a big part of it. So the baby boomers started graduating from college about 1970, right around then. So by the late 70s, they have established themselves in their careers. They're beginning to have disposable income. It's at about the same time, this is, you know, history is both overdetermined and underdetermined. It's also at the time that some computer, mainframe computing capabilities allow magazine publishers to tailor their audiences. So you start getting lots of specialty magazines. You get skiing magazines and sailing magazines. The 1970s is, in fact, a time of tremendous growth in magazine publishing generally, where you get lots of specialty publications for niche markets. And a lot of the rise in popular science magazines was a niche marketing kind of issue, which was also tied to growing consumer power. So it's And some of those consumers were seen as, yeah, they're these technocrats. These are the kids who, if you graduated from college in 1970, means you were 8 years old when Sputnik went up. You know, you're sort of in that range where that was definitely sort of part of your world. So I think there's definitely some of that. The thing, though, that keeps me from sort of definitely sort of going in that direction is it's also the time when we have the rise of fundamentalist religious groups, the growing strength of ultra-conservative political groups, many of the rise of the in the 60s and then again in the early 80s is some of the major creationism, anti-evolution movements. So there's some other forces at work in American culture as well. There's a reaction against the, you know, people who had question authority buttons. There's a reaction against those. There's an authoritarian. There's a turn to authority. And some of those people were also buying the science magazines because science can be seen as a source of authority. Many scientists think of it as anti-authoritarian, right? You're always trying to break things and, you know, question whether they're true and be skeptical. But there's also very much an authoritarian element to it, especially given that a lot of the money that was in science and engineering was Defense Department, military related. A lot of the microelectronics industry comes from there and so on. So that it's not an easy thing to untangle. That's actually what I'm working on now, is trying to see how I can untangle some of that. Andy?
You mentioned the Carl Sagan effect. And so there is this world of people who were critical of him in ways that you described, mm-hmm. which you could say his, I don't know if imagination is the right word, but he was speaking, some people thought, beyond what he knew. And so it could be that just by getting famous, people are jealous and they do that. Or it could be that it's the nature of doing such popular science that demands that you go to those places that people would be critical of, even if you didn't get famous. Mm-hmm. And you presented Cousteau as not liking the skeleton there, but there is, like, you know, there is the anti-Cousteau society also, which is people who hate Cousteau for just the same kind of Carl Sagan things, and for a story I heard about is having the Calypso on a coral reef that was full of endangered species, and they're making a movie about the beautiful environment, and the ship is in, you know, it's roped off area. No ship is supposed to be there, and the ship is there breaking up the coral, and they're making the movie about the beautiful nature, and there's a movie making fun of Cousteau. Mm-hmm. And so so the question is just some comment about, is it necessary that people to get into this popular science have to be that way, or is it a necessary reaction, or is it just what you have to say?
It's a really good question, and I've got two students right now who are working on a project on celebrity scientists, specifically to try. They're trying to get at, what are these characteristics? There was a researcher at Stanford about 30 years ago now, Ray Goodell, who wrote a book called Visible Scientists, in which she looked at about a half dozen people. Sagan was one of them. Glenn Seaborg, who was chair of the Atomic Energy Commission, was another. William Shockley, one of the co-inventors of the transistor, who also late in his life was promoted the idea that blacks are genetically inferior to whites, and a couple of others, to try to get at this question of what characteristics do these people have in common. The ability to speak in inspirational ways was clearly part of it. This ability, a sort of personal charisma, which sometimes comes from that willingness to sort of state the extreme position, not to try to put in all the caveats, is clearly part of it. But sometimes it's other things that happen. About 20 years ago, there was an article about why Einstein was famous in America. So Einstein first came to the United States in the early 1920s, 21 or 22, I think, and was greeted everywhere he went by massive crowds. So this is about two or three years after the experimental verification of the theory of relativity. And today, if you read in a textbook, you'll see, you know, Einstein the scientist was famous. Well, why was he famous? Not for his science. He was one of the most prominent Zionists in the early 1920s. And the crowds that greeted him were largely Jewish crowds celebrating the possibility of a Jewish state. But of course, we mix those in our memories. And so celebrity comes from multiple reasons. It's part of why the part of what Adrian Malone, the producer of say of both Ascent of Man and Cosmos, was trying to do, he very explicitly said, I'm going to make Carl into a star. And so some of the sort of imagery of really, you know, focusing on his, you know, these incredible close-ups of his face and so on was very deliberate on the part of the producer to create a celebrity. So it wasn't, again, we have the teamwork issue, as with Cousteau. You know, this isn't just him. It's a collaboration to create this thing. Bronowski, by the time Cosmos was produced, Bronowski had died. So Ascent of Man came out in 73, 74, and he died in 76 or 77. And by the and his widow said to Andrew Yen, be careful. I'm not sure they were actually married yet by that point, but in any case, said to her, be careful. What Adrian is going to kill your husband the way he killed mine, because he's going to drive him into this world that he may not want to go. So that there's a, you know, how much of it is him and how much of it is the other forces that are creating celebrity is unclear.
Did Bronowski get that Sagan effect stuff also?
Not quite as much. He was never, partly because he was a refugee, he never quite made it to the top of his profession. He was known, he was like a mathematical biologist or something like that. Does anybody remember? I keep forgetting to go back and double check. Basically, he was an applied mathematician, actually.
He never fit very well.
He never fit very well anywhere.
Maybe the top mathematician in his class at Cambridge, wasn't he, Senior
Rankler? I think he might have been, yeah.
He was way up there, but he was interested in such diverse things that he couldn't fit.
Yeah, he just didn't fit.
So he was at the Salk Institute, which encouraged diverse things, but he had the problem of being an interdisciplinary guy at a time when that wasn't fashionable.
Yeah, so I don't think, I think in his case it might have been the other way around, that he turned to celebrity as a way of expressing himself in ways that he couldn't do in his science. And there's some evidence that that's actually a common pattern among popularizers, that some popularizers turn to popularizing as a way of, sociological term is, enrolling allies that may then bring resources back into, various kinds of resources, intellectual material and so on, back into their science. How many of you use imagination in your work?
Some of us have imaginary friends, obviously.
Great. All right, thank you. Thank you.